I've been given the honour of introducing my friend Philip Pettit. Philip is a phenomenon. First of all, there's his velocity. He's sitting still at the moment, but it's been calculated that day and night, sleeping and waking through the whole year, his average speed over the surface of the Earth is more than 20 miles an hour. That gives you an idea of the widespread demand he's in for speaking engagements all over the world. Another thing is the direct political influence that he and his philosophy have. The clearest example was that Philip's brand of republicanism was explicitly adopted by a major national government, by the Spanish government, as its own philosophy. When José Zapatero became Prime Minister of Spain, he announced that he would govern in accordance with Philip's republicanism, and he commissioned Philip to check on him, to report on how well he was doing in that regard. I was wondering whether in modern history philosophy has had quite such a direct influence on politics, but then I thought that there are some precedents. For example, there's Karl Marx and John Stuart Mill, but after them I couldn't think of similar examples. So the next part of the phenomenon is the extraordinary quantity and depth of Philip's writings on a huge range of subjects. They range from philosophy of mind, philosophy of language, of action, meta-ethics, to moral philosophy and political philosophy. And Philip is a world leader in all those fields and in more as well. His philosophy is wide and deep. His writings constitute an extraordinarily influential body of work. I'm actually going to mention only one of them by name, and that's his most recent book, The Birth of Ethics, which came out just a few months ago. I'm mentioning it partly because I think it's an illuminating book, and partly because I think it might well constitute a good accompaniment, some good background reading for the lectures that are coming. I hope that I've judged that right. Philip is a companion of the Order of Australia, which is Australia's highest civil honour awarded by the Queen. I was disappointed to learn when this happened that it doesn't entitle us to call him Sir. Apparently, knighthoods are considered too elitist for modern egalitarian Australia. Obviously, the correct form of address for a companion of the Order of Australia is not Sir, but Mate. Philip is the Lawrence S. Rockefeller University Professor in the Princeton Center for Human Values. He's also a Distinguished University Professor of Philosophy at the Australian National University. And for us at Oxford, he's this year's Locke Lecturer. He is going to lecture to us on the subject of minds that speak.
After that, there's no direction but down, I'm afraid. Thank you very much, John, for an extraordinarily generous introduction. I should say also thank you to the committee for inviting me, the faculty for inviting me to do these lectures. I certainly consider it the highest honor I've ever received in philosophy. I think it's almost unparalleled, and I'm not sure I deserve it, certainly when I look at the list of people who've given it. But, well, I accept it nonetheless, and so here goes. So some of you will have seen the overview or these abstracts of the lectures, and the general thesis I want to explore, it's going to take me over a large range of areas, and in many of them I carry very light baggage, and no doubt will learn from both your response in the lectures and I hope from the seminars, which will be held with graduate students, I think, in primarily on Thursdays at 11 o'clock. But the thesis is basically this, that there are certain capacities of ours which are very distinctive, I think, of human beings, mental capacities, broadly speaking, capacities for thought and for interaction, which are not presupposed strictly, or so I'm going to suggest, by our capacity to speak, but which are catalyzed by our capacity to speech. In other words, the ability to speak, the habit, the practice of speaking and of hearing, of conversation, basically, of exchange, it seems to me necessitates almost, I mean, against certain background circumstances, precipitates or catalyzes, as I say, these different capacities. And I think, at least I find it illuminating, and I, you know, desperately hope that somebody else finds it illuminating as well, to see these capacities as the, so to speak, the product of our capacity to speak. I'm going to defend that general thesis with regard to six capacities, skills, whatever word you prefer, starting today with what I'm going to call, probably opaquely, but I hope at the end not so opaquely, the capacity for judgment. And then I'm going to talk about reasoning the next day, the following day, the particular character of our perceptual consciousness. Then I'm going to move on to capacity for commitment and for indeed forming various forms of social bond. Fifthly, I'm going to go on to our capacity to count as persons and what it is to be a person and to perform as selves. And then the last lecture is going to be on our capacity to assume responsibility and indeed ascribe responsibility to others, to assume it for what we do, to ascribe it to them for what they do, a capacity clearly very tightly tied up with the notion of free will. So that's a rather large area, and I'm going to do the best I can. It'll have to be at very high altitude. That's the altitude you have to achieve to cover a broad area. But I hope I'm going to be put right in areas where I'm not proficient enough and make a misstep. Okay, so today to talk about judgment, I'm going to spend the early part of the lecture introducing my way of thinking about, for purposes of today's lecture and later lectures, about agency, what it is to be an agent, and then about speech and what's involved in the idea of speaking. A very simple sort of model, just to get clear about the basics. And then I'm going to move on to argue about what happens if, in virtue of our capacity to speak, in respect of judgment in particular. I should maybe at this stage say something about the methodology. It's very kind of John to mention the Birth of Ethics book, but it uses the sort of methodology I'll be relying on here, although not so explicitly here, as in that book. I've called it occasionally, but the word is used in different senses. If Amia is here, she uses it in a different sense, I think, the word genealogy. I think of it as a counterfactual methodology of asking for a given capacity. Imagine a situation, thought experiment, where people lack the capacity you're talking about, and then see if you can tell a constructive story about how, perhaps in interaction with one another, people might come to develop that capacity. And the idea is if you can see, so to speak, how it's made, how it comes about, or how it might come about, it is counterfactual, in creatures otherwise like us, except in lacking that capacity to begin with, you'll get a good sense, or at least a possible illumination, of what it is that's involved in having that capacity. Now, this is not a, it seems to me, not a novel methodology, certainly not, but it's not one that's, so to speak, appears that often in the taxonomy of philosophical method. It's, for example, the methodology that Herbert Hart used when in the early 50s, it was published in the early 60s, he wrote his really wonderful study, The Concept of Mind. The concept of law, got the wrong topic. And in the concept of law, as many of you will remember, Hart begins with and assumes a society where there is no law by our concept of law, which is yet to be articulated. And then he imagines things that would happen almost inevitably in that society. And he builds it up stage by stage, interaction by interaction, to a story about, if you remember, primary rules and then secondary rules, but without going into the details, at a certain point he says, now, don't we have a good candidate for what law or a legal regime means in where we've been led in this counterfactual story, starting from a possible but presumably plausible scenario, may not be actual history, doesn't matter. Have we got a candidate thereby for what's involved in having a legal system? Actually, economists use it quite a lot when they ask, what is money? Because you're almost always invited to think about a society that's a barter society. Now, we know pretty well, on the basis of recent anthropological work, that there probably never were pure barter societies of that kind. But it's purely counterfactual again. And the story the economists will tell, as many of you know, is you think about the difficulties of living in a barter society. You know, I raise puppies, I've got puppies to sell. I want to get a piece of furniture, but the person who makes the furniture maybe down the way doesn't want a puppy, so I can't exchange with him. So you get all of these problems of would-be purchasers finding would-be sellers in an exchange. And under that pressure, so the story goes, whether or not you're convinced by it, a commodity is likely to emerge that everyone recognizes that a lot of people want. So I could get it even if I don't want it, or even if I, because I probably know someone who wants it. And so there's a convergence on that commodity. It might be cattle, it might be cigarettes, as in post-World War II Germany, we're told, Berlin. It might be, of course, gold or some precious metal. But as you get investment in search for that commodity, of course, you also get a demand for IOUs in that commodity for those who can supply it, and then it becomes useful in trade. And the economist takes this quite a few stages further, but again, at a certain point, says, you want to know what money is. Now, look, does that sound awfully like money? And of course, by virtue of having that story, you have a sense about, if you take that to be a good candidate for what money refers to, you've got also a sense of the role that money is playing in that society, much like the law case in Hart's genealogy. But the methodology is used more widely still. So, for example, I think that Paul Grice's method of creature construction is very similar to it, although he doesn't give it a social twist. Remember, the idea is you want to know what it is to have a certain, say, psychological capacity. Imagine a creature that doesn't have that, something you've constructed, and think about the various things you might do, each of which is independently intelligible, and see if you can reach a point where you say, now, doesn't that imaginary creature have that capacity? Again, it's this sort of this seeking to understand by means of seeking how it might be generated. You know, that's the general sort of methodology I'm following. And so I'm going to be asking, with regard to a counterfactual scenario, creatures like us, and that's really important, for example, like us in ways that language does presuppose, like creatures who are good at joint action, doing things together. People like Tomasello insist that that's really important for a language, and I've been persuaded by him. And the creatures who have those sorts of capacities but just lack language, speech, and then imagine the difference that speech might make. Could it be introduced, assuming that, and ask about the capacities it might precipitate, you know, bring on stream. And if there are capacities that speech does not strictly presuppose, these are the very simple sort of speech I'm going to imagine in my scenario, then you've got at least a claim that speech is a precipitator, a necessitator, a catalyst for those properties. And perhaps, I'm not going to argue that, perhaps the only way of bringing those properties, those capacities on stream. I'm not going to be arguing that other animals do not have these capacities, that negative claim is really going to be beyond the reach of any philosophical method. It requires empirical data. But I'll often suggest that at least animals we're familiar with do lack them. And of course, if this approach is right, I mean, if there's something at least in it, that actually speech is the catalyst for these capacities, it may well be, but I'm not going to argue that, that there are capacities that are specific to our human speaking species, so to speak. So let me begin with talking a little bit about agency. So I'm going to start with a very simple model or concept of what an agent is. So this isn't something I expect, I'm trying to deflect controversy. People might want to say, well, I wouldn't call that an agent, but this is what I'm going to call an agent. Let me give you the abstract definition first. I'm following the handout from now on, basically. What I've just said to you is stuff that will come up in section three again. I think of an agent as, and this is, I think, almost verbatim quoted from David Lewis, it's a system that reliably pursues certain purposes. So we have to have a notion of a purpose, and a system that reliably produces certain purposes and produces them according to representations that it has of the environment in which it's operating. At least does that normally, so to speak, on a good day. Okay, so let's make that a little bit more concrete. I think the notion of a purpose you can probably introduce even with something as simple as a sunflower. A sunflower, at least if my botany or biology is correct, it tracks the sun in the course of the day. Now, that's a reliably produced effect, and it's an effect which the sunflower is organized to produce. It's not just contingent. Organized, produced, as we assume, under pressures of natural selection. So it's really built to have this effect, and this effect to that extent is a purpose of the sunflower. But of course, the sunflower is not an agent. And that's basically because, and I know I quibble about some of the details here, but it's basically because it operates in one scenario, one situation only, broadly one situation, one type of situation. You get agency only when you have a system that's reliably producing a purpose, or one of a number of purposes, but let's stick with one for the moment, and reliably producing that purpose in varying scenarios. So as scenario situations vary, it still keeps producing that purpose. Now then you're going to have something like an agent. So very simple example, think of the bird, you know, that looks for fish and dives to reach the fish. Just think of that as its one and only purpose, to simplify things if you wish. Imagine the bird, you know, hovering. It sees a fish in the water, and with uncanny accuracy with many of these species, but not unfailing success, the bird will dive and catch the fish. But of course, as the bird dives, first of all, it may be at one another angle from the fish, so it's got to adjust for the angle from which it's seeing the fish. Equally, as it dives, there are going to be winds of various kinds. It's got to adjust for the wind exactly to keep itself on track. And as it moves, of course, the fish is probably moving as well. So it's continually got to readjust, and bang, you know, it gets the fish. Now, such a creature is certainly an agent by this abstract characterization. There's a purpose it reliably produces in suitable circumstances of catching a fish, and it reliably produces that purpose in different scenarios, in different situations. Now, how does it do that? Well, obviously, it's in some way registering features of this situation. It may be registering with its eyes as it sees the fish and the fish is moving. It may be registering them with its wings, you know, that respond to the currents of air and so on. The gust of wind causes it to adjust with its muscles. And that adjustment it makes in registering how things are around here, something the sunflower doesn't have to do, that adjustment actually controls or channels how it pursues its purpose. So it, in Lewis's definition, it pursues a purpose reliably, catching that fish, according to these adjustments to situation according to its representations of the situation that it's in. The representation, the purposes there leading it, the representation is an adjustment to circumstances, and bang, it gets the purpose across those variations because of these representations of the environment. I stress the bird example, as some of you will recognize, because there are various debates around representation and whether representationalism is all wrong that seem to me to trade on an excessively narrow notion of what a representation is. I think of the bird as representing its circumstances, but its representation is, so to speak, distributed probably throughout its whole body. The eyes play an important part, possibly the ears, and certainly the wings, which are, and its sense of pressure of the air against, so it's spread throughout its body. But it's still an agent because it now has a purpose that it's reliably pursuing according to representations of its environment, and representations in particular that are reliably produced themselves. I mean, it generates these representations reliably. Just to keep the examples from getting too thin, another simple example I often use is, imagine a little robot on that table, and perhaps the robot is surrounded by objects like that little recording device, some of them on its side, some of them upright, and you see the robot and you notice that it's got little stalk-like things, the end of its head, as you might call it, it's got little arms and it's got wheels, and you discover the following, that whenever it's continually, as it were, scanning its environment, as we tend to say, and whenever it sees one of these things, maybe a glass, maybe a bottle on its side, it suddenly goes into action, moves towards the bottle and lifts it with its little arms, right? Puts it upright. And you find by trial and error that it does that very reliably. So like the bird, it's got a purpose, an effect that reliably produces, it's designed to produce the effect, and it reliably produces it according to, so as we can see, reliably produced representations of where the thing on its side is, how far away it is, how near it is to it as it gets nearer and nearer and nearer, or it does that, so to speak, in favorable circumstances on a good day. Because perhaps if this is very near the edge, you know, it'll try to lift and it falls off. And you wonder, well, maybe its purpose was either to lift them or to knock them off the edge. Some of you remember Fodor's disjunction problem about content. But the normal interpretation would be to say, it's probably designed to lift them. It's just when the thing is very near the edge, that's a very unfavorable circumstance. So it just falls off by accident. It's like not succeeding. It's like the bird with the final gust of air being blown off course and not catching the fish. Anyhow, that's my abstract little characterization of what agency is. Now, of course, those are terribly simple agents that we talked about, each with one purpose. And in the case of the robot, with just one source of inputs on the basis of which it adjusts to circumstances in pursuit of its purpose. In the case of the bird, there are more. But of course, most natural agents, indeed nowadays most robotic agents, are actually much more complex than that. They have a number of input devices, like hearing or feeling or smelling, as well as seeing, if they have seeing at all. They've got many different purposes, not just one. And depending on circumstances, one or another purpose will be, as it were, selected for it. They don't just act on their immediate environment, but they act with a view to a future environment, a change that will occur, whatever. They may even, like us, act with regard to they may form representations how things possibly could be or necessarily are, rather than just representations about how things actually are around here, and so on. So I want to think, though, that across that whole spectrum of agents, right up to us, including us, I shouldn't have said up to us, but I suppose maybe I am committed to some sort of hierarchy here with the speech thesis, but including us, all of these agents satisfy the core definition. They're systems such that they have purposes that they reliably pursue according to reliably generated representations of their environment, at least when things go well by independent standards. Now, one thing I want to say about an agent is that in this sort of conception of agency, is that an agent, whenever it does something in pursuit of a purpose, I'm going to say that, well, it intends, it acts with the intention of, with the purpose of securing that purpose. It acts intendedly, as you might say, for that purpose. I use intendedly, which is actually English, but just about, not very common English, rather than intentionally, because intentionally is slightly weaker. So, for example, the bird may hate getting its feathers wet. Maybe that, so really has to, you know, flop them afterwards and dry them out and so on. It hates it, but it gets its feathers wet, and perhaps it even foresees that it's going to wet its feathers and die for that fish. It doesn't want to get its feathers wet, but it foresees that in going for what it does want, which is to catch the fish, it will get its feathers wet. Now, you might say then, although perhaps this is stretching our sense of a bird's cognitive capacities, that it knowingly wets its feathers, it intentionally wets its feathers, it's not unintentional. It could see that was part of the package of catching the fish, that you wet your feathers. So it intentionally wets its feathers, it intendedly catches the fish, but it doesn't intend to. I just mention that because it's going to come up later in this lecture. One thing to notice about an agent, though, is that agents of the kind I'm talking about, at least it need not be that they do anything intendedly about their own states of mind, as we might call them now, about their own purposes or their own representations. And I'll use the words from now on freely, their own desires and their own beliefs. So, for example, the little robot, or the bird for that matter, let's focus on the robot. The robot does all sorts of things acting on the external environment, and it intentionally moves in that direction, lifts this and so on, or intendedly does those things. But it doesn't, for example, do anything with the intention of its own representations being correct or its own desires evolving in an appropriate way. I mean, its beliefs, of course, its representations do alter all the time. You know, as it moves, see something on its side, it moves towards it, it's registering all the time how close it is now. Is it time to stop? Is it time to raise the arms? It's got these representations coming, but they update, as we say about them, but they update subpersonally or without any intention. It doesn't try to form a belief. It doesn't do anything with the intention of forming a belief. The beliefs just come and go in a subpersonal, more or less autonomic, non-intentional, non-conscious way. And that can be true of almost any agent, as far as I can see, that it acts with intention only on the external environment. Just to put in a contrast, think of Rodin's Le Penseur, thinking. Obviously, Le Penseur is trying to perhaps form a belief about something. You know, is Pythagoras's theorem really compelling or not? And maybe he's thinking through that. That's an attempt to form a belief on a certain issue. You never see, now here I am going into the dangerous territory, but I think it's fair enough to say you never see a dog, except maybe in a Gary Larson cartoon, you know, with its head resting on its paw, you know, thinking out something. And that seems to be, it carries this intuition that dogs and many animals do nothing about the state of their own minds. They just act with an intention of changing the environment about them. Their mind is made up for them by the inputs. They don't make up their minds themselves. Okay, that's enough on agency, just to give a picture of what I have in background. Now about speech. Well, this is more dangerous territory in a way, because it's such a fraught area. But let me make some very just simple remarks to get clear about what I'm going to have in mind. Think about an example that's long been in the philosophical literature from Cheney and Seyfarth, of the vervet monkeys. I bet probably everybody knows the example. Actually, Ian Rumford was using it nicely in a lecture I heard him give on Saturday. The vervet monkeys, they've got a number of different alarm calls. And in particular, just pick two. They've got one alarm call that they use for a leopard in sight, another alarm call that they use for a certain bird, say, I think it's a certain sort of hawk or eagle, in sight. And when any of these vervet monkeys in a tribe sees a leopard, they make the one call, see a bird in the sky, a dangerous bird, an eagle, say, they make another call. And the interesting thing about this is that others, and John McDowell has a very interesting commentary on this in his a paper on Strawson's work, in a collection of papers on Strawson's work, that's Peter Strawson's work, edited by Zach von Stratton many years, well, quite a number of years ago. McDowell makes the point about that, that what happens is that the vervets, presumably, when they hear the sound, it just acts for them as a stimulus, so to speak, that causes them to act as if, in the one case, there was a leopard there. In the other case, there was an eagle there. So in the one case, they rush to the tree. In the other case, they go for hiding in the bushes, right, to protect against the bird. And what he says is that the sound, I mean, commenting on Cheney and Seyfarth, that the sound is like a stand-in or a substitute for the real situation. Now, of course, you can imagine even with vervets, and we assume they're producing these sounds, for the moment, non-intentionally, I mean, just as a sort of reflex. But for the vervets, even for the vervets, you can imagine a particular vervet who maybe makes the leopard sound all the time. You can imagine that the others in the tribe might well stop responding. You know, he's called wolf too often, so to speak. This guy is just not reliable, or whatever. You can imagine that they do that. But the default response to a sound is to act as if things were, as the sound, well, you might say, indicates they are. I think of that sort of sound produced by one creature that evokes a response in its conspecifics, its, so to speak, apt audience, which is the same as the response of a given situation. I think of that sound as being or it could be, of course, a sign rather than a sound of any kind, as an indicator of the situation. Now, notice that these are non-intentionally, we can presume, indicators of the situations that the signaling monkey, the signaling vervet, is seeking to, well, he's not really seeking to do anything, if we're assuming it's a reflex. Is just sounding off. Very happy reflex, because of course the tribe is going to do better on the whole, presumably in selectional terms, competitive terms, if it evolves signs of this kind. Okay, but now I want you to imagine that we've got a hold of the notion of an indicator, and now think about an agent who produces indicators of whatever it might be in the environment, but produces them intendedly. With what purpose? Well, with the purpose, perhaps, of getting the other monkeys, say, in its tribe, or the other agents, let's move away from the monkeys, of getting its audience, in some sense of audience, of getting its audience to behave as if something or other was the case. So there's a sound S, let's suppose, and the sound is related to the situation P, and the agent intentionally produces that sound S, as its purpose, with the intention of getting those who hear it to act as if it were the case that P, to respond to things as if it were the case that P. Broadly speaking, to basically believe that P. And that's a very simple sense of belief of a disposition responsive to circumstances to act as if those circumstances obtained. Okay, now imagine further that those in the audience, in general, and perhaps it makes various sounds in this intentional way, they recognize that, you know, this guy is doing this with that purpose, to get them to behave as if P. And they recognize that perhaps because they themselves do this all the time. They also can produce indicator signs with the intention of getting others around them to act as if that situation obtained that the sign actually indicated. In that case, And now I am going to move really rather rapidly here, but just to get, you can see where I want to get. In that case, each is going to ascribe the intention, certain intentions are going to see certain goals that it will think of any producer of a sign S as having. First of all, of course, the goal of getting us to behave as if P, you know, in producing the sign S. And although, of course, this is almost certainly not going to be explicit, it's not explicit with us, it doesn't have to be explicit. And recognizing, of course, that the creature is getting us to behave as if S is not forcing us or anything in that direction to behave in that way, but is getting us to respond in that way, to believe that P, by recognizing that he's using a sign with the intention of precisely getting us to believe that P. And suddenly you've got Grice's dual intention associated with language, the primary intention of getting an audience to believe something, and a secondary intention, subsidiary intention, maybe wholly implicit, of doing so by means of revealing that intention to get the audience to believe that P. Now, imagine one further step. So I've taken you through, you know, the verb, it gets intentional, audience recognizes what the sounder, the signer is doing. Last stage, as you might say, is everyone recognizes that everyone recognizes that that's the case. So it's wholly overt, as you might say, or wholly manifest between them, what's going on, that one is producing a sign with the intention of getting others to behave as if something or other was the case, and the other is recognizing that that's what they're doing. Now, at that stage, we have what I think of as a very basic sort of communication. And what do I mean by speech? Well, very simply, what I mean by speech is an exchange between agents of these indicative acts of communication, thereby presumably increasing the information that's available on each side. Well, of course, unless they're being insincere, unless they're wanting to deceive one another. Because, of course, it's always possible now that a creature can produce an indicator intentionally, others recognizing what it wants and that it wants them to believe this, to respond to the case, on the basis of they're recognizing that that's what he's doing, trying to get them to do that. All of that can happen, but the audience be deceived because the speaker may be hiding his or her or its intention to actually... it may be hiding the fact that he doesn't actually... it may be seeking to mislead the audience. It may not itself believe that P, but try to get the audience to believe that P, to act as if P were the case. Is that a problem? Well, among agents that we assume to be like us, I think it's not as big a problem as might seem to be the case straight off, for tit-for-tat reasons, you know, for reputational reasons. If we live in a community of agents who now have developed this ability to swap indicator signs, if I can interrupt, I should say, of course, that the indicator signs that you can imagine these agents using, they may be compositionally structured as our sentences are compositionally structured. I have no story to tell because I don't think any of us fully understands how compositional structure appears actually in speech, but I'm going to just assume that. And of course, it's also the case that a given indicator sign can come to communicate different things in different circumstances, as in maybe used ironically or metaphorically or whatever, but I'm going to abstract from that too. I'm just focusing on a very basic sort of speech that is purportedly, at any rate, aiming just at communicating that a scenario that's tied to the use of a certain sign obtains in the Gricean way. But back to deception. I think the deception may not be as great a problem as it seems, because in a society of creatures like us, each is going to have to rely on others when others give them information, else they're not going to benefit from what the others say. But in order to benefit from the information that the others provide, they'd better prove reliable themselves. In other words, they'd better prove to be sources of sound information rather than misinformation, or else they're going to get the name for being unreliable. And in that case, the others will, first of all, have no incentive to tit for tat, to be reliable in return. On the contrary, they lack that incentive. They may not be reliable. They may even have an incentive to punish, which is the tit for tat, as in, I'll do the same to him, or to it, or to her, so to speak. That'll show them. Now, that's the tradition. We know that tit for tat is a mechanism, and there are variations on it, and there are all sorts of qualifications, but we know from the literature, in game theory and in evolutionary theory, that actually tit for tat has emerged as an interactive sort of pattern in many different species, including amongst human beings. I'm going to assume that if these people are subject to tit for tat pressures, where each has got to prove reliable, so as therefore to expect others to be reliable in return, and to be able to expect that he can get others to rely on him or her or it, you know, when that happens to be beneficial. If any of these agents is going to have those capacities, it's going to have to prove reliable itself. So that gives us now an image, I hope, a very crude, simple concept of what an agent is, what it is for agents to speak in this very basic way. And now on to my thesis, and I anticipated a lot of what's in three at the very beginning. I'm going to ask us to go through a thought experiment in which we imagine creatures like us otherwise, who do not speak. Think of them as higher primates, if you like. And I'm going to ask you to imagine that, as if by a miracle, maybe the miracle of evolution may have taken thousands of years or whatever, they come to speak. And I'm going to suggest that their ability to speak is going to, as I say, catalyze various capacities, and I'm going to focus on judgment in a moment, catalyze a capacity that is itself not presupposed to basic speech as I've just characterized it. So, you know, one may indicate, as I say here, where the fish are running, another may indicate where the fruit is ripening, and each will do this reliably to the extent that they wish to prove reliable and to be able to get others to rely on them and so on. So imagining a society in which this indicator speech, this very simple speech, always focused, I should say, just on the environment for the moment, really simple as well as basic speech, they communicate in this way with one another about this scenario. And I'm going to now raise the question about what the advent of such speech might bring on stream. Okay, and that takes me to section 4 in the paper, if you're following the handout. Although there's one thing I really regret not having said, so let me add this, because it's a bit of entertainment. It gives you a little break anyhow, which is in talking about how in normal communication, it's not just that I seek a response from you, by virtue of you recognizing that I'm seeking that response, as in I want to get you to believe something. It's also the case that this is overt between us. The overtness issue was much discussed in this university, for example, by Strawson and others post-Grice, of course by Grice himself too. But Simon Blackburn drew my attention to a really a lovely poem that gets this very clearly, except, oh my God, I've forgotten to bring it with me. I'm sorry. No, I have. I may remember the gist of it. It's a poem by Coventry Patmore. Do some of you remember this, if only from Simon's book, Spreading the Word? And it's called The Kiss. And the poet, so to speak, talking to this young woman, whom, as the scene is, she's been lying there, as it were, asleep. A man, her lover, has crept into the room and has taken a kiss. And the poet says something like, I saw you take a kiss. She says, 'Tis true. And he says, oh, modesty. You know, as in, oh, modesty has been cast to the winds, to which her response is, and this is where I wish I could remember the words, oh, dear. Oh, no, I have it, I'm sorry. No, I don't.
Yes, I have it. I saw you take his kiss. 'Tis true. Oh, modesty. To which he responds, 'Twas strictly kept. And then explains, he thought me asleep. And then she says, well, at least I knew he thought I slept. It's a nice case of where, you know, there isn't the full common knowledge of what's going on, and therefore there isn't real communication, but there's something sort of close to it. Anyhow, that's my little comic break, or whatever, poetic break for the moment. So the picture of hope is clear. Okay, so let's start on this as where this thought experiment. So we've got creatures otherwise like us, and they get to use this basic, simple speech. And so let's see what's likely to happen. Well, I've got a series of points, which are under four. A first point, it strikes me, is this. Suppose that I, a member of this community, do speak truthfully, and let's suppose I speak carefully, because, of course, I better also keep a reputation for being reliable in the sense of being competent, as well as being sincere or truthful. Suppose that I speak sincerely and pretty carefully in saying something. Maybe saying, well, let's stick with the hallowed example, pee. Okay, I'm going to call that as I make a judgment that pee. I judge that pee, because it's sincere and it's careful. And of course, saying that pee sincerely and carefully is judging the pee. Saying it in my heart, in Peter Geech's phrase, for mental acts, if I remember, saying it in my heart is also judging that pee. It's being disposed to say it sincerely and carefully out loud, but I don't actually go to speak out loud. Okay, now suppose that I judge that P in that sense. It seems to me that, and this is going to be true of each one of us in this community, we make judgments all the time. It had better be the case that when we make a judgment that P, any one of us, it had better be the case that in general we believe that P. That is to say, we're disposed roughly to act as if P is the case, putting aside issues of holism and so on, complications of that kind. Because, after all, if we made judgments, but, you know, maybe we believed them, maybe we didn't, you know, maybe we were disposed to act as if it's true, maybe we weren't. Well, in that case, the language would be totally useless. It would be wholly non-functional. It wouldn't serve the people in the community in giving information to them about how the world is, in trading information in that sense, like my information to you about where the fish are running, your information to me about where the fruit is ripening, or whatever. If we may or may not believe the things we judge to be the case, then that's going to break down completely. So my first claim is that for these creatures, if language is functional, speech is functional, it had better be the case that as they judge, so they're going to believe. Second point, is this going to be hidden from them? Well, no, it's going to be manifest to them. Actually, in the strong sense, it seems to me that everyone is going to be aware, maybe not explicitly, that this is the case, and of course assume that others are aware of it too, and assumes that everyone is aware of it, and the usual sort of hierarchy. Why so, Bill? Because if we didn't assume that that was the case, and as it were, as a matter of common assumption, take it to be the case, then why would we rely on one another's words ever? You would have no reason to think that these words are reliable as an indicator of how the world is, at least according to that agent, unless in general what the agent said when speaking sincerely and carefully, when judging that something was the case, actually corresponded with how he did, or she did, or it did, represent or believe the world, take the world to be. It would be totally useless again. It wouldn't be usable. The first failure would make it useless, impossible to use. The second failure of manifested would make it impossible for people to use. Okay, but now, so here's the third thing. That means that when I or you or any of us in this community say, P. It's going to be true of saying P, of judging the P, judging carefully and truthfully, saying carefully and truthfully of P.
it's going to be true that that's something we can intend to do. It better be something we intend to do, because remember, the story is I want to get my audience to respond in a certain way, as if P, I say P with this intention. Well, that means I'm aiming at getting my audience to respond in that way. That means I'm making this judgment intendedly. I desire to make the judgment, and so I make the judgment intentionally. I should say, this is really important, I mis-expressed myself a little bit. I should have said, I make the judgment as to whether P intentionally. You know, you ask me, is P the case? Is the fruit ripe on the hill? And I intentionally respond, meaning I intentionally make a judgment on that issue. And as a result of making that judgment, I say P. We can reuse the word, I judge that P is the case. Okay, so we intentionally, in that sense, make judgments about whether this or that is the case in a given issue. Of course, we're going to be in a situation in view of the manifestness of seeing that if I judge on that issue, whether P, I'm going to have formed a belief as to whether P, because it's manifest that belief goes with judgment, the second sort of stage. And that means, going back to our earlier distinction, that I'm going to, when I intendedly judge that P, I'm going to judge whether P, I'm going to foreseeably, knowingly, and intentionally form a belief on whether P is the case or not. And they're going to be naturally going together. But now this takes you to a fourth stage that's now comes on stream, I think, fairly quickly, which is that presumably on most of the issues on which we try to make judgments, intend to make judgments, and come up with a particular judgment, on most of those issues, we're going to want to have a belief in those issues. We're not just going to want to have a judgment, but not actually a belief. I mean, that, you know, there are cases where that's so, when I'm going to come to them in the final section. But in general, we'd better want to believe as well as wanting to judge on a given issue like P. And that means that not only when I make a judgment that P, I can foresee and therefore intentionally form a belief on whether P or not, it also means that I can make a judgment on whether P in order to form a belief as to whether P. In other words, my focus, my desire may be primarily on forming the belief and only as an instrument, so to speak, to that end, actually forming the judgment on whether P. So that means that I can intentionally set about forming a judgment on something with a view to having a belief on that issue. I can aim at having a belief. And now you can see immediately, going back to where I said that agency as such does not require that people do anything intendedly or intentionally even, with a view to their own representations, their own states of mind. But here we have coming on stream as a result of speech being available, that these speakers are able to do something intendedly, make judgments on this issue or that issue, maybe issues that others have asked them about, maybe issues they ask themselves about. I wondered, how is the fruit ripening? You know, what did I see? And so on. And they can actually set about intendedly to form beliefs on given issues. So that makes it very, very decisive sort of break with what might otherwise have just gone with agency. I've been a little bit lax in saying form a belief, because of course what may be the case, may certainly be the case, is that when you make a judgment on whether P, it turns out you already had a belief, you know, just you hadn't articulated it, as you might say, you hadn't brought it to words. So when you make a judgment, you may not be forming a belief on whether P for the first time. You may be confirming, so to speak, that you have that belief. The word I'm going to use here is that you can make the judgment with a view to, with your main intention being, to ensure that you have the belief that P. Okay, so we should move from forming the belief to at least ensuring that you have the belief. Ensuring where you'll ensure you have the belief, even if you had it already, or even if you brought it on stream for the first time. There's one other qualification I should also put into this story, as I've told it in the handout. It's slightly earlier, it's at the top of page 4, if I remember. And that is that you generally will form a belief when you make a judgment. That was back to the first point. But perhaps not always. Because there are cases where, you know, you form a judgment, but it doesn't catch. We all are aware of that in ourselves. I'll give you an example in a moment, at least one possible example. And of course, if it's possible in us, it's possible in these creatures that we're talking about. So think about the case where you're talking to a gambler, a regular gambler, and you tell him or her all about the gambler's fallacy. And you take him through the argument, and he says, God, I've never seen that before. Of course, it's the case if they're independent events, the red, the black, the red, the black, tails, the heads, or whatever. Then the fact that you've had a run of heads doesn't mean that there's a higher chance of getting a tails the next time. That's a fallacy. It's just the same. It's an independent event as it ever was, 50-50, if it's a fair coin, or similarly with the red and the black. And you can imagine the person really agreeing with you vehemently. But then it turns out that it just made no impact. It didn't, as were, reach his or her heart. It didn't reach into the entrails, because that evening at the casino, there the person is again, I'm going to put everything on the black. There's been 10 reds, you know. They're seized with this sort of, well, as we might think, belief that there really is a higher odds. Now, what's happened? Well, in that case, presumably, they have formed the judgment all right and formed it intendedly. And they might even have assumed they will have formed the belief, but actually they didn't form the belief. I think there are cases where judgment can fail like that. And they're worth thinking about, and they're special sorts of cases. All I need at point one is generally judgment, sincere, careful saying, is going to go along with belief. Second stage, this is going to be manifest to all of us, otherwise we wouldn't rely on one another. Third stage, this means that any one of us can intentionally make a judgment on whether P, and intendedly make a judgment on whether P, and foresee that they will, of course, thereby, in general, things going well, ensure that they have a belief on whether P. And then the next stage is, well, of course, they're clearly going to want to have beliefs on the issues where they're judging, so they may actually be making judgments on things in order to ensure more or less, because of the casino-type case, to ensure more or less that they have a belief on that issue. They want to have a belief on this issue, and hey, they can do something about it, in order, at least data permitting. Of course, it may be that the evidence is short, they're short of evidence, but data permitting, they can actually do something intendedly in order to ensure, more or less, that they have a belief on the issue in question. And now that marks, as I say, a deep break with what agency in itself entails, or sort of requires, because agency in itself is quite consistent with all updating of belief being subpersonal, unconscious, non-intentional. But what I'm saying here is that once you have a speaking species, a speaking group of agents, they will be able to do something with intention, making judgments, saying things sincerely and carefully, and they can do it with a view to forming beliefs on those issues. Enter Rodin's Le Penseur. You know, he wants to form a belief on something or other. Maybe a matter of history, maybe a matter of who was that person he met yesterday, maybe a matter of Pythagoras' theorem or some issue in mathematics. And you know, what is he doing? He's trying to make a judgment on what is true in the issue that he is thinking about. And he's doing that, presumably, in order to form a belief. So what he's doing is he's acting with intention in order to do something to his own mind, not just to the environment. Now, I think once you see that for the particular issue, you can see that this is going to release, and this is really my fifth point, a general capacity, which is a capacity to make up your own mind rather than having your mind made up for you. Now, I had a comment on desire in the handout. I'm not going to go into it now because I'll run out of time, but I'd happily explore it in the Q&A or in the seminar tomorrow. But I want to come to the fifth section. So there's a problem with this story, which many of you will have immediately thought of, which is that when I judge as to whether P or not P, I may make the judgment, of course, it's as to whether it's more or less probable that P or not. There may be probability in the content. But the judgment is on-off, right? You either make the judgment or you don't make the judgment about the issue in question. And of course, when we make judgments, judgments become standing as, so to speak, opinions. So we have opinions on all sorts of things. That was a word that Dan Dennett, I think, introduced into this discussion. But opinions also are on-off. You have it or you don't have it. I mean, you may have a bit of probability stuck into the content, as in your opinion is that it's more likely than not that P, that's struck into the content. But you have the opinion or you don't have the opinion. Now, the interesting thing is that on the best formulations of what belief is. Now, I present a belief as you believe something when you're disposed by how things present, at any rate, to act as if they were the case, right? On that sense of belief, often called credence, let's call it credence from now on, actually. In that sense of belief, credences are generally taken to come in degrees in the best formulations of decision theory. And now we have, I make judgments on off. But according to, if we accept that for a moment, I'm prepared to accept it, but the credences we're forming come in degrees. Like I have, I said P, but am I really, do I really, really, really believe it? Do I have a level one of confidence? No, almost certainly not. In probability theory, I can't unless it's a tautology, right? But maybe I have a 0.75 or 0.85. But wait a moment, what is the connection between these on-off judgments and opinions, the standard counterparts, and credences, which come in degrees? And so I need to address that issue. So let me just very briefly say what appeals to me as a line on that issue. If you ask me to make a judgment on something, let me take an example that will remind you all of a literature. You ask me, is the bank open on a Friday afternoon? Is the bank open tomorrow on Saturday morning? Now, if I say, yeah, it's open, does that mean I've got 100% credence that it's open? And suppose you say, you mean you've got 100% credence? That's great that it's open. I say, oh, wait, hold on a moment. I mean, I'm going to say it's open probably even if I don't have 100% credence, so long as the bank is not open possibilities, the non-P possibilities, are, first of all, they seem to be pretty unlikely. I'm sure I saw the bank open previous Saturdays. And they're unworrying because, you know, who cares if you miss the bank tomorrow morning, you can go on Monday, you know, or you can go to the ATM or whatever. But then you say, oh God, yes, I'm really glad you're 100% certain because if I don't get to the bank today or tomorrow, and I prefer tomorrow, I'm going to lose my house. There's a last payment for a mortgage and so on. And you say, oh, wait a moment. You know, you're going to back off the judgment that the bank is open tomorrow, right? That indicates, it seems to me, that when we make judgments, we don't necessarily, we're not 100% certain about what we judge to be the case, but we're certain enough, given the stakes at issue, given the fact that the non-P, the falsehood, so to speak, possibilities are unlikely and unworrying, we're certain enough to say P because we'd be happy in those circumstances to act as if P, in this case to get you to rely on the bank being open tomorrow. What does that mean? Well, it means then that judgments being stake sensitive in that sense, we make them in a way that depends on issues of context, what the stakes are in that context. And that means, well, what do we believe? What credence do we have to have then corresponding to a given judgment? Well, it seems to me it's going to be quite happy for any judgment that P in the context C, if we have a level of credence that would
lead us to act as if P were the case, given the stakes, and it won't matter if it's not a 0.1, sorry, not a 1, but 100% probability that it is the case. So when I make a judgment, I may have any and a range of credences, where each credence in that range has the following character: that in the circumstances I take them to be, with the stakes as I take them to be, I'm prepared to act as if I had 100% credence at P. I'm prepared to give you advice as if I had 100% credence in the case where I think nothing much hangs on it, or I'm prepared to take a certain course of action, because not a hell of a lot hangs on it, but I will, if more and more hangs on it, of course, I would not be prepared to act as if I were certain, but neither in that case would I be prepared to make the judgment. So the picture is this: I intendedly make judgments. There's always going to be a credence in place, because judgments ensure that I have a belief, i.e. a credence. What credence will be in place? Well, it'll be one of that, as you might call them, stakes equivalent class of credences. It will be any in that class of credences, any one of which would lead me to behave as if I had given the stakes, as if I had a credence of 100%. That means that now, this then suggests, though, and this is really my final round of thoughts, this then suggests that, wait a moment, you mean credences really do the, as well, the causal work, if you call it causal programming work or whatever, in generating action? And these judgments are, well, they're just sort of indicating the broad range of your credence in a given case. And that seems to make judgment now to demote judgment, where up to now I've been promoting and inflating it almost, right? And I've got a number of things to say in response to that, and I should say them quickly because I'm very close to the hour. The first thing to say is this, that consistently with this being the case, that the on-off credence may correspond with any in a, the on-off judgment may correspond with any in a range of credences. Consistent with that being the case, it's still the case that I can get myself to form a suitable credence on a given issue if I can get myself to make a judgment, if the data are enough to allow me to make a judgment. And that's still going to be really important. Actually, I can't stress how important it seems to me to be. It seems, I think that this is the first intimation of autonomy, as you might call it. You know, Freud has a wonderful phrase, wo es war, soll ich werden. Where there was an it, where there was a mechanical process, there shall be ich, there shall be I, there shall be intentional or intended control. And I think what judgment, which comes to us courtesy of speech, what it enables us to do is to attain a certain level, it's only partial control, of course, but a certain level of control over our own mental states, are focused on belief, we can get ourselves intentionally, intendedly, to form beliefs on issues. We can make up our own minds in that sense, rather than having our minds made up for us by the subpersonal impact of data or whatever. And that is a wonderful achievement. It seems to me the most basic achievement of autonomy, cognitive autonomy, interestingly enough. That's a characteristic of our species. But there are three other things I want to say very briefly about the importance of judgment, despite the fact that credence on this picture might be thought to be playing the basic causal role. The first is that, of course, by virtue of judgment in public language, we tune up our beliefs to distinctions that would not be available in the absence of speech. Simple example, you know, the dog, my dog, my wonderful beloved dog, Dougal, no doubt has all sorts of beliefs about me, but doesn't believe that I'm its owner, or as it happens, its co-owner, right? It doesn't have the distinction between ownership and non-ownership. But by virtue of gaining judgments, of course, your beliefs gain massively in the fine-grained character of the contents. There's one nether dark side to that, which is words can also mistune. I call that tuning of beliefs by judgment. They can mistune beliefs, and that's all the Burge type examples with arthritis. Many of you will remember they're exactly in that corner, and I'd love to talk about that in either the Q&A or the discussion tomorrow. The other two effects, apart from the tuning, Well, the first effect was the fact that we gain a certain autonomy, but they tune our beliefs. Secondly, they enable us to mimic belief in a very, very important way. Suppose I'm writing a book, writing a dissertation. Many of the students will be very familiar with this. Here's a piece of advice. Don't let your confidence in whether you're going to get it finished by the end of the semester, at the end of the year, ebb and flow with your creeds. It'll go up, it'll go down, and you'll never get it done. What you do is you make a judgment, I'm going to finish it at the end of the year. You freeze that judgment. You put the credences offline. That's for good practical reasons. And ironically, you'll make it more likely that you'll actually get the thesis done. That's what I call hope. You invest hope. I mean, hope is really important. It's hope is that state that sort of mimics belief. But by courtesy of judgment, you couldn't do it without being a judging species. And another is trust, and you can see how that goes. I say to someone who works for me or with me, look, I know you've got this done, that's it. Maybe I'm very unsure, actually. Maybe I'm dealing with my teenage child or something of that kind. I'm very unsure, but I say, I know you'll be back on time, that's fine. I actually don't really believe that, but I mimic the belief by, and in myself too, and in the relationship. It's not that I hide my belief. I actually make myself believe he will get it done, or will get back in time. And of course I make it more likely thereby, because of the implicit sort of faith in the other expressed by trust. There are all sorts of mechanisms that work there. But again, possible only by virtue of judgment. The final issue, of course, judgment enables us to deceive. Now, I'm not saying animals who don't speak do not deceive. There's some evidence they do. I'd love to talk to people more knowledgeable than me about that. But they also enables us to self-deceive, which has always been a problem. How do you deceive yourself? Well, once you recognize the role of judgment in relation to belief, you know, you can do it. You can imagine a gambler, you know, sincerely making this judgment, right? And then sort of just putting behind his back the fact that he rarely ever follows these judgments, you know? Can you give up smoking? Of course, I've done it many times, you know, forgetting that actually the effect doesn't always come as true. It makes that sort of self-deception really possible too. And finally, and this is a great theme of Hobbes's, it makes it possible for people to, as it were, profess belief very easily. You know, mute animals, it seems to me, only form beliefs on a need for action basis. But now we can form beliefs not just on a need for action basis, but on a need for, you know, situating yourself in relation to others. I'm one of the gang, you know, I believe one of the religious gang or the political gang or whatever it might be. As Hobbes said, you can form beliefs far too easily, you know, especially if it's in Latin, you know. He thought this was the fault in scholasticism. And with that in mind, let me just end with that nice quote from Hobbes, from De Homine, where he says, by speech, man is not made better, but only given greater possibilities. Thanks very much.